Something I thought we've not really covered before is actually cancer.
Right.
You know, people get very worried about cancer, but there's an awful lot that can be done. Things have moved on a long way since I graduated. So there's things that we can do now that could have never ever been dreamt about being done 30 years ago. I thought we'd possibly cover that as a topic. Mainly this has come on because I've thought of a couple of cases that I've had in the last few days where we have had problems, or that there's been things that have been identified. So it just brings it to the fore that it's such a common problem.
Mm-hmm.
I thought we should really talk about it.
Right, that sounds like a good idea. Now, in humans, there are some very common cancers, aren't there? Is it the same in the pet world?
It is. There's some very, very common cancers that we deal with, and some of the common cancers, likes of mast cell tumours in dogs, if they're identified early and they're treated surgically early on, don't cause any problem at all. But if you leave them and they become more aggressive, then they can cause an awful lot of problems.
Can you just explain that? Because what did you call it? It's a...
Well, a mast cell tumour.
Mast cell tumour, what is it?
Right, a mast cell tumour. A mast cell is one of the white blood cells in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And it can form an abnormal growth on the skin. And that abnormal growth on the skin can look like a quite a wide range of different things. But as that grows, what you'll tend to find classically with a mast cell tumour is that the owner will see that the lump seems to be a bit bigger one day and then a little bit smaller the next.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that the mast cell releases histamine. So therefore, if the animal knocks it or something like that, then suddenly the tumour will appear to be bigger because of the histamine release that causes swelling of the tissue.
Mm-hmm.
As that swelling settles down, then the mast cell, the actual tumour itself, becomes smaller. The classical appearance is it starts as like a little red raised lump sort of thing within the skin.
Mm-hmm.
But often if they're deeper in the skin, you won't see any pigment changes. And they can actually be under the skin in the fat layer sort of thing. And in those ones, you just see a general swelling.
Because I was going to ask, actually, what kind of signs have you got to look for? You know, like in a human, for example, for breast cancer, you've got to check your breast regularly, see if there's anything that changes. Is there something to do as well with your pets?
Yes, the key is just having an examination of them on a regular basis. So if you run your hand over them, if you're running your hand over on a regular basis, if you've got a lump there that you've never noticed before, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to dive to the vet that day.
Yeah.
But as a matter of rule, if that lump doubles in size within a 3 or 4 month period, it needs to be checked out.
Okay.
But some lumps don't necessarily play to the same rules.
Mm-hmm.
So the most common lump in a dog is going to be something called a lipoma, which is just a fatty deposit.
Right.
And they aren't really clinically of significance at all. But there's not a lot of difference in feel sometimes between a lipoma and some of the other tumours.
So maybe it would be safer just to take your pet to your vet, just to double check.
It would be safer to take it to the vet and just make sure that the vet does do something called a fine needle aspirate. So if they stick a needle into the mass, we can either have a look under the microscope at the cells or we can send that away.
Right.
But having a look under the microscope, you can eliminate something that's, you can see something that's a fatty tumour, and a lot of the time you don't even need to use a microscope for that, because what you're getting out looks like fat, right? So you get a clear liquid that's greasy coming out. But with other tumours, by having a look under the microscope, we can often give a very good idea of what type of tumour it is.
Mm.
And by having an idea of what tumour it is before you get to surgery, it then means that you can vary how much tissue you take away. So if you have a mast cell tumour, you have to take at least 2 to 3 centimetres in all directions around the tumour to be able to clear it.
Right.
Right. But with an adenoma, you might only need to take 2 or 3 millimetres.
It's a big difference, isn't it?
So it's a huge difference. So, depending on the area of the body, if you're taking a tumour off a leg where you haven't got a lot of spare skin, if you know that you can get away with only 2 or 3 millimetres, you can end up with a nice, neat job and all sewn back up again. But if you have to take 2 or 3 centimetres, you then have to start talking with the owner about how you're going to get that closed, because it may not be able to be closed on a surgical wound.
Mm-hmm.
It may need to be closed by dressings and that type of thing.
Oh, right.
But it's false economy, and it's misleading to try and have a mast cell tumour and only take 2 or 3 millimetres because you won't clear the tumour.
Mm.
And the best chance of clearing any tumour is the very first chance.
Yeah. So with something like that, with your mast cell tumour, what are the recovery rates like?
Oh, very good.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got, they class them as being grade 1, 2, 3 and 4. A grade 1 tumour, even if you've got a 1 centimetre margin, will be cleared with surgery. Yeah, so you'll clear probably nearly 100% of grade 1 tumours. Grade 2, you'll clear probably 80-odd percent, 85%. Grade 3, it drops down to probably 60% that you're going to actually clear with surgery. Mm-hmm. And grade 4, you're not going to clear. Right.
So when talking about grade 2, 3, 4, is the worst the cancer is in the first place?
The worst the cancer is, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the grading is based on the rate of replication. So when they look under the microscope on histopathology, they're looking at the number of cells dividing in a high-power field sort of thing.
Oh,
so,
okay.
So they're looking at the rate of cell division. And the rate of cell division is quite clear, and the biological behaviour of the tumour changes depending on how fast it's going to be growing.
Okay.
So the one that's dividing very, very fast, the grade 4 tumour, won't just stay in the local area, that will spread throughout the body.
Mm.
And because it spreads throughout the body, the only way of trying to solve those is looking at chemotherapy. But there are chemotherapies around that can be used that can make the animal live quite a normal life for an extended period of time. The grade 1 tumour is never going to spread anywhere. It's only going to stay sitting in its local area.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So taking that away, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just one type of tumour. There is a lot of different sorts of tumours.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are the things, and what are the types, and what are the things you'll be looking for in our pets?
Well, some of the other types of tumours, they aren't as easy to pick up. There was a dog I saw on Friday that had a splenic tumour.
Right.
Now, the splenic tumour, I could see there was a problem when the dog came into the waiting room or into the consulting room, but the owner might not have done because it's just that its tummy was hanging down a little bit more. So, the abdomen was what we call pendulous. But it wasn't in an even way, so it's suspected to me that there was something in the abdomen, and when I had a feel, there was.
Mm-hmm.
So that one had come in for his vaccination booster.
Mm-hmm. So they had a lucky escape, really, basically, because they didn't know he had something wrong with him, and they just came for vaccination.
It didn't actually have a lucky escape, one, because it was a splenic hemangiosarcoma, almost certainly, and it actually bled 2 hours, 3 hours after I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
It
Good
actually
God.
Bled out.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore it didn't have a very good escape at all. But had we seen it a few weeks earlier, then by picking up on it, we may have been able to get it to surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Right? By getting it to surgery, there would have only been probably a 25% chance of getting to surgery and fixing that one. Without looking at chemotherapy or anything like that as well. But every tumour that we deal with has a different biology. So, some of them are very responsive to chemotherapy and some of them are not. But when we start talking to clients about cancer, the only word that scares them more than cancer is chemotherapy. Because, they both start with C, but the chemotherapy starts with a big C. So people think of chemotherapy and they think of someone that they knew that had chemotherapy that was really, really poorly. But when we talk about chemotherapy in pets, we're not talking about kill or cure, which, in humans, a lot of chemotherapy has moved on to a degree where you talk to the chemotherapy people and the cancer units and they say, right, well, I can do this for you, and if it succeeds, you might live another 25 years. But there is a chance that you will die during the procedure. And most people, given the choice of, I'm going to be dead in 6 months, or I could die with the treatment, but if the treatment works, I could live 25 years, will put themselves through hell in the hope that they'll live 25 years. We use the argument with pets that the pet doesn't have the ability to give you the permission to be put through hell. So therefore, with pets, we try and work on the basis of don't do harm, but keep them that you can gain the maximum length of life without causing damage. Mm-hmm. Right? So we try and make it that the overall thing with a pet is keep them happy, don't make them sick, we're not making the hair drop out, we're not causing them to have all sorts of other problems. And if they start having problems, then we back the dose off a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that means that it's not as effective in animals as it is in humans with chemotherapy, because we're not taking them to the limit. But we're also not hospitalizing them in, you know, disease-free units and, you know, everything else that's done. We haven't got the ability to do that in animals in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
And the cost of doing it is phenomenal.
Yeah, it certainly sounds it. So basically, if somebody's pet is going through something like chemotherapy, they take it home at the end of the day, aren't they?
That's right. So most chemotherapies that we use, some of them the animal would be admitted for the day, but the vast majority of the chemotherapy that we'd actually use in surgery, some of it is tablet form, so the owners are actually administering the chemotherapy at home themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as they're wearing gloves and they're doing everything properly that way, then there isn't really any problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
With other chemotherapies, we're actually just administering it by injection. So the animal comes in, it might be in with us for half an hour, and then it goes home again.
Right? Well, that's quite good then.
So it's trying to make it simplistic as being able to to do it, and also trying to make it affordable to do as well.
Cause it's much less traumatic for the pet as well, isn't it, really?
It's much less traumatic for the pet, and that is the underlying thing. So that is the key behind it all. The animal that's distressed in its environment is much, much less likely to make a recovery than the animal that is happy in its environment. So, yeah. And if we're dealing with animals in a hospitalised situation and we're giving them a chemotherapy and we're getting animals that have got infectious disease coming in as well, that animal is far more at risk in the hospital situation than it would be at home of picking up a secondary infection. But chemotherapy isn't something that anyone would want to go through lightly, and it's not something that we would ever sit in the consult room and say, right, we're going to start this and we're going to start it in 10 minutes.
It must be quite early days for this then in terms of pet medicine, is it? How long have we been doing chemotherapy on pets?
Oh, we've been doing chemotherapy on pets for over 20 years.
Really? I never heard of it before.
Yeah, it's quite a long period of time that we've been doing it for. Yeah, I've certainly been doing it myself for, nearly 25 years since I first gave anything chemotherapy. And it goes back a lot, lot longer than that chemotherapy has been done. But there's been big advances in chemotherapy and in the understanding of how it's done and what drugs are available to use. With certain things like submast cell tumours, there is now very specific drugs that are out there that only treat mast cell tumours.
Right,
So there's tablets. There's tablets now that were made by a French company that are targeted, that they just treat mast cell tumours.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be very, very effective. There can be quite a few side effects involved in treatment with them. We've had a couple of very good successes where the animal has been pretty critical and has gained 6 to 12 months of fairly good quality life.
Well, you must have much less side effects now compared to 25 years ago. I mean, it must be much more, it's much more smooth, the treatment, I mean.
Oh, yes. The biggest thing is the understanding of the drugs we use are a lot better. But the other thing that we've got as an advantage is that we've got a lot better drugs. The drugs we used 25 years ago, we had two or three different drugs that we would use to treat anything.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about pet cancers.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a topic that I think people are often too scared to talk about.
I would have said so, actually, yeah. And it's not something that springs to mind, is it? So, what are the things, and if we're worried about our pets, it's not always a lump or a bump, is it? What are the signs should we be looking for?
It's not. A lot of the time, cancers don't show as any external sign at all. So if you've got a cancer of an internal organ, or you've got something on the lungs or whatever, it may just be presented as shortness of breath. It might be that you're getting weight loss.
Mm-hmm.
So characteristically, most cancers will lead to weight loss. So the animals start to particularly lose muscle mass.
Right.
So their overall body weight may not change, but their muscle mass will change. So you find that the muscles start to become thinner, so the spine starts to stick out a little bit more. So like the dog I saw on Friday with the splenic tumour, the splenic tumour was probably about, well, a little bit smaller than the size of a football, right? So it's quite a large tumour. So that dog hadn't lost any weight, but it had lost a lot of muscle. So, but the body weight on the scales was the same as it was previously. So from the owner's point of view, they didn't think the dog had lost weight because they'd had it on the scales. So you can get distracted a lot. The other things like leukemia and lymphomas, you can end up with them where the lymph nodes all come up. So around the body, you've got lots of lymph nodes, under the neck, in front of the shoulders, behind the back legs, in the groin, etc. That can all become very large. Or it can just be in the bone marrow. So what you can see if it's just in the bone marrow is the dog just gets very short of breath, or the cat gets very short of breath, and they start getting very pale. So because they're not able to produce the red blood cells anymore, because the bone marrow is being overtaken by the cancer in the bone marrow.
Right. I've got a question for you there. You say that your pet gets pale. How can you, because they're covered in fur. How do you tell?
What you tell is you tell on their eyes and you tell on their gums.
Right.
So when you're looking at the gums, if you lift up the lip of your animal, unless you've got slices of a chow that has very, very black gums and a black tongue, you'll see the colour of the tongue and you'll see the colour of the gums. And they should be a nice pink colour.
And would you notice something maybe with a stool as well? Would you see a difference in there or no?
In certain occasions you will, but only if you're getting bleeding in the stools like that. So in most cases you won't actually see anything much different in the stools. But if you've got a tumour that's bleeding into the intestinal tract, then you'll see what we call black and tarry faeces. So when you're getting the bleeding, you get a metallic smell from the faeces and you get this black tarry substance coming out.
Can I ask something else as well? Would you, for example, have breeds that are more likely to have a certain kind of cancer?
Very much so, yes. Right. So, when you're dealing with, particularly with likes of the boxers, boxers get an awful lot of skin tumours.
Right, so you would watch more for that, basically, than another dog.
That's right. Yeah. But the good part about boxers and their skin tumours, the main one they get is mast cell tumours, but they mostly get grade 1 and 2.
Right.
Whereas certain other breeds are more likely, if they get a tumour, they'll get a grade 3 or 4.
Right.
So Labradors tend to get more aggressive tumours than the boxer does. But the boxer might end up with 5 or 6 over his lifetime that are all low grade.
5 or 6? Gosh, it's a lot, isn't it?
Some of them can end up with multiple. There's other tumours that you see in young animals. There's a tumour called a histiocytoma that we generally see in dogs that are under 12 months of age.
Really?
And the histiocytoma is a fairly unique tumour in that it disappears on its own.
Okay.
So we don't need to treat it. We need to identify it. And then over a period of time, it takes about 6 weeks from when it first comes to when it's disappeared altogether.
So it's not malicious. It's just
It's you have a variant of it called a histiocytosis, where which mainly occurs in flat-coated retrievers, which is fatal.
Right.
So where instead of just getting one of them, they get lots and lots of them.
Oh gosh.
Right?
Okay.
But flat-coated retrievers, there's somewhere close to 100% of flat-coated retrievers die of cancer.
Oh wow.
So, you were saying about breeds, and there's certain breeds, and with flat-coated retrievers, they're probably the breed that has the worst record on cancers.
Oh, right, okay.
But then as a breed, they're lovely. Really are. They're such nice dogs.
So, for example, if someone came with such a dog from that breed, would you recommend them to come at least once a year to check them over, to check there's nothing going on? Or?
Well, everyone should be coming at least once a year anyway,
right.
Because you should be having your vaccinations at least once a year.
Of course, yes, sorry.
And when you're having the vaccinations, there should be a full check-over of the animal occurring. So there should be a full check of the dog. Or the cat, and having a good check of the heart, good run over the over the skin, checking there's nothing else going on.
Okay.
And any queries at all that the owner's got, the vet should be satisfying those queries and making sure that the owner is happy with that everything's been looked into.
Right.
Yeah, but some tumours are not as easy to see. Sometimes, you can have tumours within the mouth that the animals see, that there's a little bit of a bad smell in the breath.
Mm.
But they don't necessarily open the mouth and see them.
Yeah, it's true.
So when the vet sees them, hopefully the vet will open the mouth properly and be able to examine. You can see blood in the urine sometimes, and that can be associated on occasions with tumours of the bladder.
Mm-hmm.
So the symptoms that you're going to see will depend on what organ system is actually affected.
Mm-hmm.
Brain tumours can show as behavioural problems, so the animal can suddenly start behaving very different than it used to do.
Right? Okay.
You see occasions where dogs suddenly start walking backwards and things like that for some appearance. And I'm saying that one because one of the only causes that we see of dogs that suddenly start walking backwards for no apparent reason is a brain tumour mm-hmm. in a certain part of the brain.
Right, so something to watch out, basically.
Yeah, so there are a lot of things that can lead mm-hmm. to suspicion of tumours.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, even though there's been big advances in chemotherapy, the treatment of choice is surgery. So the treatment mm-hmm. of choice is, there's a saying, if in doubt, cut it out.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's a very true thing to look at when you're dealing with cancers. If there's a suspicion that it may be something worse on an initial look at it under a microscope,
mm-hmm.
then we remove it and we send it away for histopathology.
Right.
Now, the histopathology will look at it in a lot more detail than you can look at under the microscope from a little needle biopsy.
Mm-hmm.
And that will give us an answer as to what we're dealing with. And sometimes we'll take tumours away and it'll come back and it'll be just an abnormal accumulation of cells and it's not cancer at all.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So not every lump is actually dangerous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A lot of lumps are going to be cysts and things like that, cysts and adenomas that are not going to cause the animal any problem at all during its lifetime.
Sorry, no, I was just going to ask, you talked a lot about dogs. What about other animals or smaller pets, like your rabbits and your hamsters, gerbils, that kind of thing?
We do see an awful lot of tumours, particularly in gerbils.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, male gerbils, the scent glands become cancerous on a very high incidence.
Really?
Right, so... Uh-huh. Yeah, and a lot of those can just be adenomas.
Mm-hmm.
So, surgery and removing them, you can often treat them and cure them.
Mm-hmm.
But there's probably about 30% of them that are adenocarcinomas, in which case you remove the actual gland itself
mm-hmm.
and you send it away and it comes back with a nasty result and the tumour mm-hmm. is actually already spread in the body.
Right? So how would you know? Because a gerbil is very small. How would you notice something's wrong with the gerbil?
They're very easy to notice with gerbils and that, because the scent gland is around where the belly button is.
Oh, I see. So you would see something
different.
So it's
on the outside mm. and you can mm. see the physical growth of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
With your small pets, your hamsters, mice, all that type of thing, mm. Internal tumours are not really treated, right? Rats get an awful lot of tumours. We
mm-hmm.
see an awful lot of rats with tumours.
Mm-hmm.
And we have operated on quite a number of them over the years. But invariably with rats, the type of tumours that they get
mm-hmm.
are going to come back. We don't have a very good success rate in operating on rats with tumours
mm-hmm.
and having a cure. Right? Just because of the type of tumours they are, they get a lot of fibrosarcomas and that type of thing in rats that aren't really
mm-hmm.
treatable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You can alleviate the size of the lump, but it comes back.
Is it just harder because they're smaller animals, so it would be harder to access? Or
a big part of it is because they're smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Being smaller means that it's assessing them as far as we wouldn't generally with your rats and that, go and take x-rays and ultrasounds and that type of thing to investigate before we do something. But cats and dogs are very different when it comes to tumours as well.
Mm-hmm.
Cats don't get anywhere near the amount of cancer that dogs get.
Mm-hmm.
But when they get it, it's usually bad.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So a mammary tumour in a dog, the majority of mammary tumours in dogs are treatable just surgically.
Mm-hmm.
When we're dealing with mammary tumours in cats, they're really nasty things.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be a lot more radical on the cat with surgery on a mammary tumour than we do in the dog. Generally, the cat, to have successful removal of a mammary tumour in the cat, you're having to take the entire chain away.
Wow.
Because the tumour has probably already spread from where it was to the next bit to the next bit.
They're quite resistant, look at. They don't let you see that they're poorly, do they?
It's a lot of the time they can get a fair size before an owner notices.
Right.
You know, and it depends on the animal. I mean, with Jeffrey, I'm not sure that he lets you rub his tummy every day.
That's true. You probably can't pet them as much as you can pet dogs as well. That's true.
No, you can.
You'd lose a limb. They do it on their own terms, though. The cats dictate how much you can actually examine them. Whereas the dog... Yeah, dogs dictated as well, but yeah, in general, owners spend a lot more time running their hands over their dog checking for things than they do with their cat.
I do think dogs, especially the big ones, are easier to handle than some cats.
And some little dogs are not easy to handle.
No, I can imagine. But you'd never get any. They've got some tempers,
some small dogs, don't they? Much more than big dogs. Sometimes you see two dogs in the park and you've got a small dog, tiny, aggressing, massive dog. You're thinking, surely you just noticed you're a bit in danger here, but no.
Have you never heard of little dog syndrome?
No?
Yeah, yeah. It covers all species, I think.
Is it? It's not just dogs. Really? I hadn't noticed. little dog syndrome. They think they're bigger than they are, don't they?
They do. You'll often find a little chihuahua or whatever that's trying to keep a Great Dane at bay, sort of thing.
I find the Yorkshires, I used to have a Yorkshire, they've got quite a temper on them Yorkshires, I find.
Yeah. Well, where a lot of that comes from is actually the way that the owners deal with them. Because the owner with a big dog knows that they need to keep the big dog under control.
Right.
Because if the big dog goes off the rails, they won't be able to handle it.
Yeah.
With the small dogs, a lot of the time, owners let them get away with an awful lot because they're only little.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the dog starts to win.
So they're a bit like the spoiled children, aren't they?
Like the spoiled children. Exactly. The little dogs are often treated like spoiled children.
Okay.
And as a result of being treated like spoiled children, you end up finding that they become a little bit more difficult to deal with. So we get some little dogs, and if they're very little, you're worried about how do you get hold of them to restrain them, because they can break. I mean, I had a little dog in the other day who's only 1.3 kilos.
Oh, wow.
He's an adult, and he's a little bit aggressive.
That's tiny. I just realised how small that is.
1.3 kilos is really
1. tiny. 1.3 kilo. It's very, very small.
About 2 pounds, is it?
It's 2.2 pounds to the kilo.
So just a bit more, two and a half pounds. It's really
two
tiny,
pound,
isn't it?
What sort of dog was that?
Is
it a cross? A crossbreed, maybe?
Trying to think of the breed of dog that it was, but it's a miniature for its breed.
Oh right!
Yeah.
Wow.
But it used to be a handbag dog, so it was a little trophy.
I was going to say actually, I think also the problem is with small dogs, they humanise them a lot. They put a lot of clothing on them and they treat them a bit more like babies that they were with a big dog. And I think maybe that would have an incidence on it, wouldn't it?
It has a major effect.
Yeah.
The pack instinct still occurs in every dog, in that the dog will try and become the leader of the pack.
Mm-hmm.
If you humanise the dog too much, then the dog thinks that you're inferior to it in the pack.
So therefore the dog becomes
higher up in the pack.
Oh.
And will challenge anyone else that tries to come into the pack.
Oh, wow. Right.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the pack instinct of wolves and that, you can use that across all dogs. It doesn't occur in people or anything like that. But in dogs, it doesn't matter what type of dog, that dog, unless you have set rules and keep that dog in its position, it will actually work on the pack mentality. So you can end up with certain households where the dog is the leader of the pack, the dog is the alpha, and the dog considers that the owners in the household are the lower dogs. Right.
So there you go, put Bruno in a tutu at your peril.
I haven't seen many Brunos in a tutu.
Oh, you know. Sailor outfit, then.
No, we do see quite a few dogs that come in little outfits.
Really?
Yeah.
Personally, I find it a bit intense for the dog, I find.
Clearly.
Yeah, but there's...
Not doing them any good.
No, definitely. If they start telling you what to do in your house, it's no good.
If they tell you what to do in the house, there's no good. I mean, we've had before stories where people have been bailed up on the worktop by the dog and won't let them off the worktop because... The partner is the one that's the alpha in the house, the dog's the secondary, and the other person in the household's considered below. So the dog will stamp its foot down and say, right, okay, you're staying on the worktop today.
I'm starting to relate to this. This happens in our house, and I'm definitely at the bottom of that pecking order. Okay, so we're in the studio by being joined by Paul Wilson. Paul's talking to us about pet cancers. So, it's a fascinating subject, this, isn't it, Paul?
It's an extremely broad subject. I mean, we're just really playing around at the edges of it at the moment. I think one thing that people are probably interested in is what can they do to try and prevent it occurring in the first place? Mm-hmm. Because prevention, obviously, is the one step better than cure. If you don't get cancer in the first place, then you don't have to worry about how you're going to treat it. Mm-hmm. And there's certain cancers that are definitely preventable. One of them is to do with skin cancers, mm-hmm. right? So... with skin cancers, particularly something called a squamous cell carcinoma, which is caused by the sun's rays, right? Mm-hmm. And we see that mainly in pets that lie out in the sun a lot.
Mm.
And it's mainly in cats that we get a big problem, right? Mm-hmm. Now, if you own a cat, you'll know that cats love the sunshine.
Oh, did you?
Oh, yes.
Find a sunny spot and the cat will be laid in the middle of it.
They'll
sleep in it, they'll do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And if the cat has got dark pigments, it doesn't cause it a problem.
Right.
But if you've got a cat that's white, and particularly one that's got a pink nose and white ears, then you end up with problems.
Oh, are they more fragile maybe than black
cats? Yeah, the problem is if they've got a pink nose, they've got no pigment in there to actually absorb the sun's rays.
Oh.
So therefore, that pigment is there.
Wow.
Will stop the harmful effects of the solar radiation.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a pink nose, they end up getting burnt, right?
Oh.
So they get burnt on a regular basis, and the burning of the nose then causes the skin cancer to occur.
Mm-hmm.
The same on the ear tips.
Mm-hmm.
White cats or cats with white ears, so you can have a black and white cat that's got white ears and it'll still be susceptible.
Mm-hmm.
But the ear tips, we often see problems where the ear tips burn. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually use just normal sun cream. So,
oh, wow. I wouldn't have believed
a lot of
you could
do that. A lot of your sunblocks that can be used can be used on your pet as well, particularly on the nose and on the ear tips. Right? And the first sign of getting a skin cancer in a cat is that you'll see that the ear tips will start to become a little bit crusty. So the edges of the tips start to, it's hard to describe any other word than crusty, but it's that where it burns a little bit, you're getting secretions come from within the skin that form like a scab on the tip of the ear.
Mm-hmm.
And those scabs, when they're precancerous, they can be treated relatively easily, and you can get the same sort of little scabs on the nose where you're getting... crusting forming on the nose.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be treated often, just topically with fairly simple ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
If it gets more serious than that and it starts to become ulcerated more, then what we end up having to do is to take the ears off, right? So you take the ear flap off. And sometimes you have to do that more than once. So you might take a section off and then have to go back and take the whole ear off. And sometimes you have to take the nose off, right? So
gosh, it's quite a big step.
It's quite a big step, and it's not one that you want to do.
No, exactly.
So there's a lot of things that we would do before we'd take the nose off. We'd freeze the lesion and things like that, or we'd use electric cautery on it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's creams that we can use with it. And there's also, we can send you to, there's a place in North Yorkshire called the Pet Cancer Vet, the Pet Cancer Clinic in North Yorkshire.
Mm-hmm.
And he has various things that he can use. He can apply a gel that's photosensitized, so you can apply a light on it with this photosensitized gel, and that can help to eliminate certain cancers. So there's lots of things that can be done, but it's an easy one to actually try and eliminate.
So you said you need to put cream on the tip of the top of the ear and also the nose. Do you have to do it also on the belly sometimes? They don't have that much hair there, or...?
We don't tend to see very much of a problem on the belly.
Oh, right. It's just basically on the head.
It's right. mainly you're looking at nose and ears, right?
And what about the other breeds, you know, like you've got... I can't remember the name of that breed, the Egyptian one, you know, with no hair at all. You'd have to put cream everywhere on
him. You'd have to put it all over.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think of that, would you? No?
But mostly, if you've got people that have got Egyptian males and that, they don't tend to let them out.
Oh, right, of course.
Yeah, so they're mainly indoor cats.
Oh, I see.
And you don't see the problem in indoor cats.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it's only where the cat is outdoor and it's in the full heat of the sun that you tend to find a problem. One of the other things that is of huge benefit on treatment of cancer as well has been neutering your pets, right? So, yeah, by neutering the pet, it decreases the risk of a lot of cancers. But that's only if you neuter them as an adult, not if you neuter them as an immature animal. So, you know, we're looking at, you know, with male dogs in particular, you can't get cancer of the testicles if you haven't got testicles, right? You can't get cancer of the uterus or ovaries if you haven't got those, right? So they're easy eliminated. But cancer of the prostate is not that uncommon in male dogs, same as it is in male humans. And by when you're looking at those, the two groups that are at risk are the dogs that were castrated prior to 6 months of age and the dogs that were not castrated at all.
Okay. Oh, so you'd have to do it slightly after 6 months, and that's less danger to...
We tend to say to do them after a year of age.
Oh, right, okay.
So if you leave them until they're a year of age, and the reasoning that is thought behind that is that the prostate is activated by testosterone in the bloodstream. So with the testosterone in the bloodstream, the prostate then starts to respond to testosterone. So testosterone is the key that makes the prostate function and makes the prostate enlarge. So if you're taking away the testicles, you're taking away the testosterone. So therefore, you've effectively turned off the prostate.
Oh, right.
And the prostate will shrink back and become vestigial. But the thought is that if you take away the testosterone before the prostate has become active, then it's never actually been activated. So therefore, it can activate spontaneously with some other cause later on. And then it activates abnormally and it just grows, right?
And would you say you have the same thing with female? Obviously, they don't have prostate, but I mean, you know, when you actually... normally, you tend to operate them before 6 months, don't you?
No, we don't. We would always allow them to have a season first.
Oh, right. I didn't know that, you see.
Well, it varies between vets. There are vets that try and do them all before 6 months of age, so males and females. I'm a great believer in that they need to reach maturity first.
Not with cats.
Okay, no.
Just for dogs.
With cats, we tend to still do cats at about 6 months.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, there is arguments with cats that, you know, there is still benefits to leave cats to 9 months as far as joint development. If you neuter a cat too early, then they get very leggy, right? Yeah, but the difficulty is with cats that there's a much, much higher risk of pregnancy with cats if you're leaving them. And there's also with male cats, there's a much higher risk that they'll start spraying. And once they start spraying, it can sometimes be a permanent thing, even if you've neutered them, that it's become a behaviour pattern for them.
Yeah. Because I was going to say, actually, obviously for cats, because I never had a dog when I was older, I just assumed that you'd have to operate them before that 6 months, so before they actually reached maturity. So they didn't feel frustrated, because I just presumed if they had already, for example, a litter or something, and then you operated them, then they knew what it felt like, and they still had the need of trying to have a litter? Or would they... It's just nonsense.
No, I think that's... I don't think that's correct.
Okay.
There's people use the other argument that they should have a litter beforehand, which again is incorrect.
Oh, right, okay.
But if you've got a male dog and, you know, he's used a stud.
Yeah.
Right? The male dog that's used a stud and allowed to mate a bitch will then be chasing after bitches all the time. Because he knows what he's out there. Effectively, but if he's never ever had opportunities, he won't be as much trying to chase.
Oh, right, okay.
So in that way, yeah, that sort of thing plays exactly what you were saying. But I think it's more that, yeah, if they've not been neutered, then they can, if they've had something, then they would miss it, I think.
Right.
But once you've neutered them, you've taken away that hormonal driver.
Oh, yes, of course. See what you mean now.
Because you've removed the hormonal drive that is actually there that's making them do the behaviour, the behaviour should stop.
Right.
Not all behaviour would stop, but the specific sexually related behaviour would stop.
Okay.
Right. But this survey's been done, or retrospective survey that was published a couple of years ago, or probably 3 or 4 years ago now, on the incidence of certain tumours in dogs, and comparing tumours to the time of neutering. And the difference in tumours on certain things, particularly bone cancers and that sort of thing, in dogs that were neutered very early compared to dogs that were neutered later, there was about a 4 or 5-fold increase in tumours in the ones that were neutered early.
Gosh, that's a difference.
So it is quite a big difference. 20-odd years ago, the standard practice was to neuter early. Yeah, and the rehoming charities are all still saying that we should be neutering early. But we tend to, as a practice, we've adopted much later neutering. Because the problems that you're neutering for are generally going to be not there until the animals are a little bit older.
Yeah.
The difference is breast cancers in bitches. There is statistically a lot more risk of a breast cancer occurring if the dog has had multiple seasons. So that's why we tend to say, let them have one season. Then they've hit maturity effectively, because all the hormones have been in there to make them be mature. But then neuter them before the second season.
Right.
So with very large dogs, there may be an argument to neuter them after the second season. Because of the growth. But there's... Yeah, diet also plays a big effect.
Right.
If they're on a poor quality diet, then they're more likely to end up with problems than they're on a very good quality diet. The supplements likes of omega-3 that are supposed to have an effect at how tumours develop. But it's only the same in people. That if you have a very poor quality diet, you're far more likely to get problems than you are if you have a good quality diet.
No, it's true. I mean, it's what I was going to say, actually. It's what you do with yourself. You take care of yourself. If you're healthy and you do everything that's right, then you have less chance to fall ill to something like that.
That's right. But then I've found out recently myself that vitamins make a huge difference as well, because I've had major problems with vitamin D. And again, vitamins, not all vitamins can be produced by all animals. So the guinea pig can't produce vitamin C.
So he needs it a lot in his diet every day.
Guinea pigs have to have green foods in the diet or vitamin C supplementation. The rabbit can produce its own vitamin C, so it doesn't need to. But there's only two animals that I'm aware of that don't produce vitamin C, or two types of animals. I'm calling, your primates are included with humans. But humans don't produce vitamin C, and guinea pigs don't, but most animals do. Then you've got your amino acids. You've got essential amino acids that are required. And in people, we've got 2 or 3 that are essential that you have to have in your diet. Dogs can produce nearly all of their own amino acids.
Oh, right.
Cats have to have nearly all of the amino acids supplemented in the diet. Cats can't produce their own. Right? So a cat's diet in the wild of mice, squirrels, anything else they're going to catch... contains all the amino acids that they require. But if you give a cat a meal and you're going to say, right, I don't want to feed tin food, I don't want to do this and the other, I'm going to give the cat home-cooked food, the heating process destroys most amino acids, or a lot of amino acids, so therefore you would actually be giving the cat a very deficient diet.
Right. I was going to ask you something. I know it's not really linked to cancer. It's about the food you just talked about. It's like, obviously you said cat and dogs have got really different needs.
Extremely different requirements.
And it's quite actually funny because my mother-in-law, mom has got a dog, and that dog will not eat dog food. All she wants to eat is cat food. So doesn't that mean she's got too many vitamins in her diet? Or is it like...
No, the problem with a dog eating cat food is that cat food has a much, much higher level of protein in it than a dog requires. So cats are what we call obligate carnivores.
Right.
And dogs are more omnivores.
Okay.
Right? So you don't have to necessarily... You can't have a vegetarian cat. Right?
Yeah.
It doesn't exist. A vegetarian cat... you have to have so much protein in there in the diet in the cats just to make them function.
Right.
You can have vegetarian dogs. So dogs can cope with a vegetarian diet.
Oh, I didn't know
as long
that.
As there's sufficient protein in there to be able to cope with it.
Oh, right.
Dogs are a lot closer to humans as far as how their overall nutritional needs.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're feeding dog food to a cat, that cat will end up deficient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So thiamine and that would be just not in the diet in anywhere near enough to be able to support the cat. So the cat will have all sorts of problems being fed dog food.
Right.
If you feed a dog on cat food, then you've got a higher risk of kidney problems and that sort of thing because of the level of protein that you're providing.
Okay.
But the dog would actually cope on cat food.
Right. It's just, but I mean, she will not eat dog food. She will just eat cat food. It's just...
Do you find that animals, like a bit like humans, crave certain foods when they're deficient of something? Does that...
They do. You see certain situations where, if I get a client coming in with an animal that is eating soil, right, so they've got pica, so they say, well, yes, the dog has started eating dirt out of the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Then I start looking for tumours of the intestine,
right?
Mm-hmm. Because it's often associated with bleeding from the intestinal tract and iron deficiency anemia. So, when you're getting certain deficiencies, the animal will actually change behaviour to try and supplement that deficiency. So iron deficiency anemia, you'll often associate with dogs that are eating soil, And a big cause of that is often to do with intestinal tumours. We don't see that very often. But if I get a client coming in and saying that their dog has suddenly started eating soil, then I start looking for things that way.
That's a bit similar to cats eat grass, isn't it?
Cats eat grass because they want to make themselves sick.
Yeah, because they've got a tummy ache. Yeah.
Mm. Isn't that for worming as well, or am I totally wrong?
It could be an indicator that they're needing worming. So yes, it could quite easily be an indicator to say that they're due for worming, which reminds me I need to worm my own cats. So we should remember last month. Yeah, so it's bad vet. His cats are overdue worming. There's a lot of reasons why an animal will adopt a certain behaviour, right? As far as eating certain things, grass, etc. But mostly it's fairly innocuous that they're just doing it. Mm-hmm. Right? It can be a habit. Dogs that eat stones and that type of thing is definitely just a habit.
Right.
It's not that they have a deficiency of stones.
No, I didn't think they needed them. That's fun. My tortoise eats stones if you don't watch them. But I think helps them digest. I think it's something to do with the digestive system.
There are certain animals, and I'm not sure on tortoises as to whether it's correct or not, but there's certain animals that will swallow a stone to go into their digestive system to help grind the food. Yeah, so certain birds would swallow small pebbles and they sit in the crop and help digest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gosh, you wouldn't think so, would you? I mean, you wouldn't eat a stone yourself and think, oh, that's going to help me out.
No, I've never got into the habit of thinking that.
No, it's not one of my normal cravings. No, not at all.
But you do see women that are pregnant eat coal.
I was going to say, some eat actually lots of random stuff, don't they?
Does that really happen? Is it not just a...
It's very rare, I think, but it does happen.
It does happen.
Really? Yeah,
we've had a staff member that ate coal.
Oh,
really?
I think someone I've heard of craved smelling a certain amount of smell. I think it was bleach, so she used to sniff the bleach every day just because she liked the smell. It's just very weird.
Mm.
Very weird. Bleach is a good healthy smell.
But we had used to get a craving for a McDonald's in the middle of the night and make her husband drive to Bishop Auckland from Newton Aycliffe to buy a McDonald's. And when he got back with it,
she didn't want it anymore.
A third of the time, she wouldn't want it anymore.
Yeah, that's perfectly normal. I think that's perfectly acceptable. I don't see any problem with that at all.